available to them but cheap pig iron, and repeated hammering beat out the impurities to create a reasonably formidable blade. The swords were never quenched in blood, and their edges were not tested on condemned criminals stacked one atop the other like cordwood, none of which was to say the blade wasn't strong and sharp as a razor.
"Sharon, under the desk," Erkan said.
She obeyed and scrambled past on hands and knees.
"Mr. Voldemar," Hammond said.
I will not die cowering, Mr. Hammond."
"Yes, sir."
Hammond positioned himself at the mouth of the hallway, at the corner. Erkan drew his sword and flanked the elevator doors, choosing to put the dead end against his back, even if it meant leaving himself no option for retreat. If he were to die this day, he would die fighting, not cowering. He raised his sword high. The elevator reached the top floor. The door slid open. A handgun sprang into view. The blade was strong and sharp. Blood fountained from the stump. The maimed gunman drew a gasping breath, priming for a scream. Hammond squeezed off 3 quick shots, silencing him. Deafening pops accompanied plumes of muzzle flash like dragon's breath. Hammond withdrew behind the corner. Bullets punched through drywall, sending up puffs of white dust. Erkan, as if guided by a vision of the future, knelt and drew back for a thrust. A second assailant sprang into view and fired where he expected his target's head to be. Erkan lunged, the chisel edge point of his katana leading the way. It slid effortlessly into the man's belly. Erkan dashed past the open elevator, pulling his sword like a lever. The man doubled over, pressing his hands to the bloody fissure that resulted. Erkan whirled around and dropped the katana across the back of his neck. Hammond stuck his gun out around the corner and fired blind into the hallway. One bullet connected. A third man fell, clutching at the spurting hole in the center of his chest. An imperfect peace descended. The elevator doors rattled rhythmically, like an asthmatic's lungs, as they tried to close around the dam of corpses piled up between them.
"If there's anyone else in there, throw your gun out and step into the hall. Slowly. Hands first," Erkan said.
A pistol arced through the air and landed on the carpet with a dull thud. Hammond peeked around the corner. A pair of shaking hands inched into view, followed by their owner, a chalky-skinned young man. His eyes were dark pinholes against twin full moons. Erkan stepped out to face the man. The boy, really. Graffiti splashes of red stained Erkan's summer suit. Beads of blood slipped off his katana like mercury and rained onto the carpet.
"Tell me who sent you," he said. "I want to hear it."
"I don't know," the young man stammered.
"Fuck you don't,"
Hammond said. His finger tightened on the trigger.
"Who sent you?"
"Octavio Ham,"
his voice dialed up half an octave.
"It was Octavio Ham. Please don't kill me."
"What's your name?"
"Isaac."
"Isaac."
Erkan closed the distance.
"If I'd asked you not to kill me, would you have spared my life?"
Isaac began to cry.
"I thought not," Erkan said.
And then he ended the man, driving the point of the katana through the soft underside of Isaac's jaw and up into the base of his brain.
"Police are here," Hammond said.
Erkan cocked his head and listened for the wail of approaching sirens.
"Better late than never, I suppose," he sighed.
Scenes like this did not develop. They seemed to spring into existence fully realized, an explosion of chaos in mid-blast. The first ambulances pulled onto the property the same time as Rose, and for the life of her she couldn't precisely remember how she wound up playing traffic cop for the steady stream of cruisers and ambulances and fire trucks that arrived after her. Her radio squawked non-stop, instructions getting passed along rapid fire, and she had to take it on faith they were coming from someone who had a fair grasp of what the hell was going on. She'd spotted Chief Drennan walking around, and wondered if he'd come out to quarterback the op himself. If so, it'd be his first time in the field in years. The story unfolded in dribs and drabs. The body count officially hit 20, and promised to climb further. It would be hours before they'd have a final tally, and hours more before they could move on to the especially grim business of identifying the casualties. After that, the detectives would take the many bits and pieces they'd gathered and tackle the Herculean challenge of putting them together into a semi-coherent picture, revealing the whys and wherefores, and, most importantly, the identity of the monster who'd sent a death squad into the heart of the city. Rose looked around and caught sight of all the sheets spread out about the parking lot, hiding the most public of the bodies from the growing crush of spectators and media gathered at the property's edge, pressing against the chain-link fence. And she swore to God Almighty if Erkan Valdemar were to be revealed among the dead, she would walk right up to Drennan and confess all, and accept whatever punishment came to her. No justice could be too harsh. No one else was supposed to die. None of her comrades were among the deceased, but that was the coldest of cold comforts. There were fathers and mothers under those sheets who wouldn't be returning home to their children tonight. Husbands and wives who would never see their spouses again. And it was her fault. Worse, it was all for nothing. Rose moaned at the sight of Hammond leading Erkan Valdemar out of the building, his arms outspread to keep the police at a respectable distance. Isabel emerged from a cluster of officers and threw herself into her husband's arms, heedless of the blood caking his summer casual suit. Chief Drennan approached them, said something, then personally led them to the closest ambulance. One leaden step at a time, Rose made her way over. Hammond intercepted her before she could close the distance by half. He fixed her with a look, and then turned away, hands folded casually at his waist.
"Did you know this was coming?" he said to the air.
"No," Rose said.
"I'm going to ask you again."
"And I'll tell you the same thing. I had no idea this was going to happen." It was enough of a truth, but Rose couldn't tell if Hammond bought it. "Do you think I'd let innocent people get gunned down like this?" Hammond threw her a quick glance. "This is a blessing in disguise," Rose said.
"It is it?" Hammond said.
"There's no way in hell this can't be traced back to him. All we need is one suspect to spill his guts." She immediately regretted that turn of phrase. "And point detectives in the right direction, and they can nail Ham to the wall."
"You better pray that doesn't happen."
"What? Why?"
"If Ham goes down for this, he'll do his damnedest to take Mr. Valdemar down with him. That can't happen. We have to keep our distance from this incident, so it can't be traced back to Mr. Valdemar. That means, if any of his crew did survive, you need to make sure they don't talk."
"How the hell am I supposed to do that?"
"That's your problem, Sergeant. Don't make it ours. You keep things quiet, and then you take care of Ham. Directly, if need be."
"Christ, Hammond, I need time."
"You don't have time. So start getting shit done." "One phone call, Sergeant," he said, walking away. "Don't force us to make it."
Rose's radio crackled. The body count rose to 22. A pit opened up in her belly and swallowed her heart. 22. Anne checked her phone again. No calls, no texts.
Shit.
She got up off the couch and paced a frantic lap around the room while the TV droned on about tonight's top story, the massive shootout at Valdemar Exports and Imports in Worcester. 27 people confirmed dead, and 2 Worcester police officers among the 11 people injured, making this the greatest tragedy the city had known since the Worcester cold storage and warehouse fire of 1999. 2 officers injured, but not dead, and no word whether Rose was among them. Anne returned to the couch and glowered at the TV as if in accusation, her hands unconsciously twisting the hem of her shirt into a rope.
"I'd know if anything was wrong."
Her heel stomped an anxious tattoo on the floor.
"I'd know."
It was dark out when Rose returned, shambling into the hotel room they now shared in the name of economy. Anne hurried to her side and guided her back to the small couch. She felt so strangely light, like she was made of brittle fall leaves ready to drift away on the slightest breeze.
"Rose," Anne said.
With a trembling hand, Rose pointed at the television, now showing an aerial shot of the Valdemar warehouse taken earlier in the day, before the shrouded bodies had been cleared from the parking lot. Two dark dots stood at the corner of the screen, unmoving. The camera had captured Rose's surreptitious conference with Hammond.
"That's my fault," Rose said, and a rainfall of tears washed over her cheeks. "I did that."
"What? I don't..."
"Ham sent a death squad after Valdemar. They killed everyone they found."
She shook her head.
"That wasn't what was supposed to happen."
"You had no way of knowing," Anne said.
"Doesn't matter. I caused this."
"Rose, no."
Anne turned off the TV and took Rose in her arms.
"Octavio Ham did that, not you."
"Innocent people are dead because I was too concerned about covering my own ass," Rose said.
There was a hardness there, deep beneath the brittle whisper.
"You did what you had to so you could protect the people you care about. There's no shame in that."
"Then why can't I feel anything but shame?"
For this, Anne had no response.
"Anne,"
Rose seemed to deflate in Anne's embrace.
"I'm tired."
"I know."
She kissed the crown of Rose's head.
"You sleep, my sweet lass."
Somehow, Rose found it within herself to smile, if faintly and all too briefly.
"You haven't called me that in ages," she said.
And she slept.
It was dark.
Not black, but dark. Rose ran her hands along a length of wood covered in canvas. A cot, maybe? She sat up, blinked, waited for her eyes to adjust. A thin strip of sunlight, warm and brilliant, peeked beneath a door. She rose and walked toward it, her outstretched hand trembling. She touched something round and cool, a doorknob, solid brass. She drew a girding breath and turned the knob. She stepped into a church. It didn't look like any church she'd ever been in, but that was the word that immediately came to mind. She wasn't alone, not quite. The woman sitting near the fire pit gave the embers an idle stir and laid down the poker. Dark hair fell in an unkempt tangle from beneath a knit cap, framing a face a little too hard to be properly pretty, even when she smiled.
"Hello, Rose," she said.
"Hello, Mary," Rose said.
Mary gestured, inviting Rose to sit. Rose kept the fire pit between them.
"Is this it, then?" she said.
"Is this what?"
"When you take over. I knew I couldn't keep you away forever. I've felt you fighting to come out."
"Ah, Rose," Mary said, shaking her head.
"You are badly mischaracterizing our relationship."
"What is our relationship?"
"We're the same person," Mary said, as if stating the obvious.
"I am not you."
"You are me, and I am you. You have my temper, though you keep a tighter rein on it than I ever did. You have my stubborn streak. You have my taste in ladies," Mary said with a wink.
She added soberly,
"It's good to see Anne again."
"Yeah, it is," Rose said. "If we're the same person, why did I grow up to become a cop?
That doesn't seem your style at all."
"Oh no, not by half. That's because you didn't live my life. You got to grow up in this century, in this country, with parents who loved you and raised you right."
"Nurture over nature."
"There you go."
"Then why are you here now? I never felt you before."
"Because you never needed me before. You've always been a strong woman, another trait we share. And you could handle anything life threw at you. And then, Alex fucking Cornelius came along and changed everything."
Mary spat with as much contempt for the man as Rose ever felt.
"You needed strength you didn't have to pull through."
"You."
"Me. And now you need me again.
I don't think it's unfair to say you've hit rock bottom, yeah?
Weight of the world's become a little too much for old Rose to bear by her lonesome. I'm here to help you carry the load. And all I have to do is let you take over completely.
That's right, but it wouldn't be for good.
Only until we sort out this mess with Valdemar.
Mary stood and stretched out. Rose jumped to her feet, fists balled. Mary made a gesture of peace.
Way I see it, that isn't going to end until Valdemar is dead. And the only way to make that happen is to make that happen.
But that's not your style, is it?
No.
But I don't know what else to do, Rose said miserably.
That's why you let me take care of it. You have a problem spilling blood.
I don't.
So you step aside and let me do what needs doing.
And then you'll go away?
Mary frowned.
That's what I thought.
I don't want your life, Rose. I truly don't. But once you let me in all the way, I can't promise you'll be able to completely shut me out again. You won't be gone, but you won't be the same person you were before. That's the price.
And if I refuse to pay it?
Mary shrugged expansively.
You wake up and pick up where you left off, and I go back to being that nagging voice in the back of your head.
Really?
Really.
This is your choice, Rose. Yours and yours alone.
Mary circled around the fire pit, circled around to Rose, and held out a hand.
You can trust me.
Can I?
Rose, my dear. Would I lie to me?
Rose stared at the proffered hand for a good long time. Anne bit down on a curse directed inward as much as toward the sturdy steel box in her hands. Of the many talents she'd gained in this life and the last, correctly guessing the combination of a gun safe was not among them. And how foolish she felt for believing she might possess an innate but heretofore untapped talent for safe cracking. She reset the little dials to 0000 and prepared for another go by the dim glow of her phone.
Anne? What are you doing?
Anne's mouth dropped into the startled O of a child caught red-handed, filching money from her mother's purse. The impulse to lie was fleeting, but deception flavored her answer nevertheless.
Protecting you, she said. This won't stop until Valdemar's dead.
And you were planning to do what? Drive over to his house, break in, and shoot the man while he slept?
If that's what it took.
Come here.
Anne sat on the edge of the bed. You made me a promise once, Anne. Do you remember?
That I'd never abandon you again, Anne said.
They'd sworn many oaths to one another, some more serious than others, yet she sensed that was the promise in question.
And what would you be doing if you ran off and got yourself killed?
Saving you.
I don't need saving. I need you fighting by my side. That's how we'll beat this bastard.
The gap between them shrank.
Will you do that for me? Stay by my side until the end.
Always.
And forever?
And forever,
Anne said, and she could hold back no more.
I love you, Mary. I know we're strangers in so many ways, but I can't help how I feel. I love you. I always have.
Anne braced for the rejection. She'd said her piece. Let the chips fall where they may. Fingers slipped into her hair, grabbing it gently, and pulled her into a kiss that sent fire coursing through her body. Surprise rose and fell in a single thundering heartbeat, and Anne returned the kiss with equal passion. And that was returned to her with even greater intensity. A hand nimbly removed her belt, undid her jeans, and then sought out what was hidden within. The kiss, yet to end, smothered Anne's startled moan. The temperature in the room seemed to surge to volcanic levels. Anne wrestled out of her jacket, but that brought no relief. Her skin prickled and burned with a heat only one thing, only one person, could extinguish. The world tilted, pitched, Anne fell onto the bed, a weight on top of her. Clothes, roughly removed, fell to the floor. Two naked forms vined together.
"Mary,"
Anne gasped before insistent lips silenced her again. Those lips worked their way down Anne's body, so slowly, inflicting an excruciating, exhilarating torture. Every caress and nip and kiss sent a thrill through her. These were not the timid, random explorations of some stranger learning the topography of her new lover. This was not discovery, but rediscovery. And when at last those lips dipped between Anne's legs and kissed her there, she cried out, long and loud, ebbing and flowing between a sound much like laughter and a sound akin to sobbing. Anne wept joyful tears for her Mary's return, and she wept tears of mourning for lost Rose. Anne reached out. The sheet beneath her hand was cool to the touch. She sat up. Light from the bathroom cast a soft glow into the main room, where a familiar shape finished buttoning up her uniform shirt. "Sorry, I was trying not to wake you." "You're going to work?" Anne said. "I have a job to do. I'm an officer of the law. I have to protect and serve." Anne frowned at the distinct note of mockery. "Rose?" "Rose isn't in right now." "Oh, no." Anne knelt at the edge of the bed. "I'm so sorry." "Sorry? What do you have to be sorry for, love?" Mary said. The endearment stabbed Anne in the heart like a hot needle. "I wanted you back so badly, but not like this."
"Anne, it's okay."
"No, it's not. You didn't want this."
"Anne, it's okay."
This was Rose's choice. I offered my help. She accepted it. And if I'm going to get through this, I'll take all the help I can get.
"All you have to do is ask."
"Glad you said that, love. I have a job for you."
"Whatever you need."
"Find out where Octavio Ham lives."
"Ham?"
Anne nearly choked on the name.
"Why?"
Mary leaned in and kissed Anne tenderly.
"So I can kill the bastard," Mary said.
23. A hand, surprisingly soft for a man's, slid up Julie's side until it settled on her breast and gave it a squeeze.
"Good morning."
"I am withholding judgment on that," Julie mumbled.
"Let's make it a good morning, then."
Her bedmate, Stefan, was it Stefan? That sounded right. Pressed his morning wood against her.
"One for the road?"
"Oh, well, when you say it like that, how can a girl refuse?"
He squeezed her again and kissed the nape of her neck.
"That was sarcasm, good sir. You really should acquaint yourself with it."
"Oh," Stefan said, deflating. "You're not in the mood."
"My head is pounding and my mouth still tastes like cheap tequila, so no, I am not."
"Oh," Stefan said again, and he rolled out of bed.
Julie cracked an eye and without much interest watched him pick his suit up off the floor and get dressed. He'd presented himself as such a promising lover, well-dressed, well-mannered, and he never overtly angled for a hookup. He might not have been looking for one, but his intentions were neither here nor there. She'd needed a good lay, and badly, and he'd been as sound a prospect as any.
"I had fun last night," he said, sitting on the foot of the bed to put on his shoes.
"I'm glad you did."
"You didn't enjoy it?"
Julie rolled onto her back and propped herself up on her elbows.
"Your oral skills are non-existent. You fuck like a dog humping his owner's leg, and you rolled over and fell asleep without ever bringing me close to an orgasm. So no, Stefan, I did not enjoy it."
"Stephen," he said, red-faced. "My name's Stephen."
"Stephen, after such a disappointing performance, do you really want me to remember your name correctly?"
He stormed out without a further word. Julie fell back onto her pillow. A yellowed water stain hovered above her, cloud-like. A Rorschach test splashed across dingy plaster that hadn't known pure whiteness for years.
That one looks like a butterfly, Doctor.
A hand drifted down to the triangle of her pubic hair, and she considered finishing the job Stephen, not Stefan, had barely started. A dull ache, the leading edge of a hangover, settled in behind her eyes, and she dropped her hand to her side.
Putain, she muttered,
and she drew a long, slow breath. The air tasted of must and mildew, with a faint, sickly sweet undertone of semen from where Stephen, not Stefan, had clumsily pulled off his condom and spilled its contents onto the top sheet. She'd made him sleep in the wet spot, his doing, his discomfort. What precious little arousal she felt shriveled into a twisted knot of disgust. She closed her eyes and tried to will herself back to sleep, a sleep so deep it would carry her through her headache, and, if there was a God and he was merciful, through however many more days of torturous monotony lay ahead of her. Last night was the first night she'd dared to venture out, a desperately needed furlough from her self-imposed exile at the Pine House Inn. The desk clerk had quite unwittingly put her back in her old room, and she might have called her disappointing tryst a warning from on high not to tempt fate a second time. Might have, were she one who believed in God and that he was merciful. Her phone buzzed. She recognized the number, but, erring on the side of caution, answered with a neutral, "Hello?"
"It's me," Anne said.
"Miss Bonnie, to what do I owe the pleasure?"
The silence that followed spoke volumes.
"Is something wrong?"
"Maybe. It's Rose. She... Mary's awake."
Julie sat up, the hangover fogging her brain dissipating in an instant.
"Did you see the news last night?"
"No," Julie said, withholding the reason why. Anne gave an abbreviated account of the previous night's catalytic events.
"Is she there? Let me speak to her."
"No, she went to work."
"Perhaps not the best idea."
"Her mind was set. She asked me to do something for her, but I could use some help."
Julie got up and began to dress.
"I am back at the Pine House Inn. Come get me. And as long as you ply me with endless hot coffee and pastries, I am yours to command. I will help you hide the bodies of your enemies if you so decree."
Anne laughed humorlessly.
"Funny you should say that."
It would not be inaccurate to describe the morning shift briefing as funereal. Owens read from her notes as if delivering a eulogy, and Mary's, Rose's, fellow officers listened with bowed heads, their expressions somber. Owens reported, dispassionately, that the one gunman captured at the scene died overnight of police-inflicted gunshot wounds. In doing so, denying detectives someone to question. Every other suspect died at the scene or escaped. Mary pressed her lips together to hold back a groan of relief. Once on the road, she called Hammond. "I need to talk to Valdemar," she said.
"I'll make sure he gets the message," Hammond said.
"Put Valdemar on."
"No, you can tell me whatever."
Mary hung up. Hammond called back immediately.
"Hello," Mary sang sweetly.
"Don't do that again," Hammond said.
"Then don't give me the runaround. Put Valdemar on."
"He's busy."
"Then tell him to call me when he's not," Mary said, and she hung up again.
Hammond called right back.
"If you do that one more goddamn time," he said, seething.
"Fuck you, you mouth-breathing, knuckle-dragging ape," Mary said. "Fuck you. You think after seeing what I saw in your boss's freezer I'm scared of anything you might do to me? Take your threats, shove 'em down your throat, and choke on 'em."
Hammond breathed into the phone, each exhalation the snort of a bull being taunted by a fluttering red cape. "Tell your boss that our only suspect died last night," Mary said. "So there's no one left to connect the hit back to Ham. Be a love and do that for me, will you? And next time, put him on the phone when I tell you to. You bore me."
"Bitch," Hammond began.
Mary hung up on him once again. He didn't call back. Mary's back ached dully, down near the base of the spine, from hunching over the wheel of her cruiser all day, an old habit making itself known again. She spent the elevator ride up to her room, stretching out, cat-like. thinking of how wonderful a hot shower would feel, and wondering if she could talk Anne into a back rub, perhaps while in the shower. A warmth bloomed in her cheeks, at once thrilling and shameful as conflicting memories and impulses clashed. Until last night, the closest Rose Booker had ever come to being with a woman was during her junior year in college. She met Lisa Tanner at a party hosted by Phi Kappa Phi, a frat with a reputation for throwing epic ragers. They hit it off instantly. Conversation turned to flirtation in short order. A suggestive glance here, a not-so-casual touch there. At Lisa's suggestion, they retired to Rose's room, where they spent several minutes kissing, groping, rubbing. In the middle of trying to pull Rose's jeans off, Lisa abruptly ran to the bathroom and expelled the two Long Island iced teas she'd pounded. Rose, who'd been only slightly less drunk, found she was in equal measures relieved and disappointed that things stopped there, though not so much so that she ever felt tempted to avail herself of the many subsequent opportunities that presented themselves. Word of her aborted tryst circulated quickly, and she spent the rest of her college career saddled with the nickname Lesbait. The elevator stopped with a tiny lurch. Mary got off. Anne and a bleary-eyed Julie sat together on the couch, consulting Mary's laptop. "Isn't this cozy?" Mary said. "Rose," Julie yawned and stretched.
"Sorry, I'm told it's Mary now."
"It is?"
Julie nodded.
"I am so sorry."
"And I'm getting right bloody tired of people telling me they're sorry. I neither want nor need your pity, Frenchie. So keep it to yourself and let's talk business, shall we?"
"Frenchie," Julie said, amused yet mildly offended.
"All right, love, tell me how brilliant you were," Mary said.
"Don't give me all the credit," Anne said. "This was a joint effort."
"Willa wrote for her college newspaper and picked up a few tricks," Julie explained.
One of those tricks was how to locate people who do not necessarily want to be located. Willa learned to start big and work small, so Anne and Julie began their morning of amateur detective work by determining where Octavio Ham lived in the broadest sense. That was easy enough, given Ham's tendency to insert himself into photographable situations. And once they were reasonably certain he had a home in Sturbridge, Julie directed Anne to the town assessor's webpage, and there they found a treasure trove of information on Ham's luxury home, located at the end of a private road, off of Bennett's Road, east of Leadmine Pond. Julie had Anne pull up the bookmarked webpage.
"Aside from less useful tidbits such as its ownership history and its most recent valuation, which is obscene, by the way," Julie said, "this gives us a general sense of the floor plan, should we have need of that information."
Mary took the laptop. A sense was all the record provided in the form of a greatly simplified line drawing, filled in with purple and pink to indicate indoor and outdoor areas respectively. But a legend beneath the drawing broke down the major habitable areas by type. Finished basement, first floor, upper floor, finished attic, and square footage. Above that was a color photograph of the front of the house itself, a stately colonial with a low frame porch.
"Google Earth gave us the lay of the land," Anne said, prompting Mary to jump over to that tab on the browser.
The house sat in the middle of a sea of green, all alone at the end of a road with a few gentle bends. Mary zoomed in, and that brought into focus a dark line ringing the property like castle battlements. Google Street View filled in another small blank. The road leading up to the house, paved but not lit, terminated in front of a high iron double gate. Once past the barrier, the street became a long, straight driveway that rose up a slight hill and led to the front door. Security cameras sat atop the brick pillars anchoring the hinges on either side.
"How are you feeling, love?" Mary said. "You up for a raid?"
"You have to ask," Anne said.
"What are you planning?" Julie asked.
"Mischief," Mary said. "Bloody violent mischief."
The plan, though simple, was rife with potential to go wrong. That was always the way of things back on the Revenge. Mary was the font of ideas who enthusiastically painted plans in bold, broad strokes. Anne scrutinized, analyzed, and criticized until Mary's proposals had been purified and distilled to a workable plan that, if all went reasonably well, would not get them all killed. Jack Rackham's only contribution to such endeavors was his name, which gave rise to the myth among his crew that he was a tactical genius on par with Cromwell. Julie refused to replace Jack as a symbolic presence in the process, and she joined Anne in challenging each step of Mary's mad proposal. Anne approached it from the perspective of a habitual overplanner, and worried that Mary's penchant for recklessness was as strong as ever. Julie, whose id had never steered her so wrong she could not extricate herself from a predicament, worried that enough of Rose was still in control that, at a critical moment, she might stay her hand. And if this plan were to succeed, they would need to strike like avenging angels, brutally and without mercy. Mary reminded Anne that she was, historically, a proud adherent of the shoot, and stab and punch and kick, first, and ask questions later, philosophy. The fact that she had a fairly sound plan from the get-go should stand as proof positive she had a handle on the matter. As for mercy, Mary assured Julie that mercy had no place in their impending assault. They would receive no quarter, therefore they would offer none. This was all about survival. They left the hotel, together and for good, and re-established their base of operations at Rose's apartment, reasoning it would provide them with the necessary measure of secrecy the hotel lacked. Besides, no one else was using the place. Mary said this with a melancholy note that did not go unnoticed by her friends. Before departing for work the next morning, Mary gave Anne and Julie a list of items they'd need, along with explicit instructions on how to obtain them, so they'd be harder to trace back to the women in the inevitable event of police involvement. As for the final piece of equipment, Mary took it upon herself to make those arrangements at the end of her shift. She changed at the station, stripping away all trappings of Sergeant Rose Booker, before paying a visit to Bermuda. She made one reconnaissance pass by the chop shop to check for T's electric blue caddy. It was the only car in sight, and then parked behind it, their bumpers kissing. She found T alone inside, sitting in his office, his feet on a fourth-hand desk, badly in need of refinishing. A boombox older than either of them sat atop a filing cabinet, blaring NWA through its one functional speaker.
"Shit,"
T said with a start.
"Aw, for... now what?"
Mary closed and locked the door. She silenced the boombox, letting T catch a glimpse of the handgun tucked in its belt holster. His expression held steady.
"Bitch, I don't give a shit if you're a cop," he began.
"Am I a cop?" She spread her arms. "Am I wearing a uniform? Do you see a badge on me?"
"I see that gun."
"Good.
What do you want now?"
"I want to talk to you privately."
"About what?"
"Erkan Valdemar." T's short time in charge of the shop had imparted a leader's boldness. He answered Mary's statement with cool indifference.
"Never heard of him."
"Yes, you have," Mary said, before utterly shattering T's calm veneer. "He's the man who murdered Moby and Tamir Ray and hung their bodies on meat hooks. But you knew that, didn't you? You've seen it. That's how Valdemar is keeping you in line." T's complexion took on a greenish cast. "I have an offer for you," Mary said. "A little quid pro quo."
"I don't know what that is."
"It means, if you help me, I'll help you."
"I ain't talking to no cops."
"T, look at me." T met her eyes. "Do you see a badge on me?"
"What do you want?"
"I need an SUV, something big and heavy and durable. I'm not too picky. As long as it runs, holds passengers and some cargo, isn't obtrusive and isn't going to get flagged. And I need it in 3 days, gassed up and ready to go."
"But you're not too picky," T said. "Too bad for you I don't run that kind of operation."
"Too bad for you I'm not stupid enough to buy that. I know what this place is. I know what kind of man you are, and I know that you'd love to be rid of Erkan Valdemar."
"So would I."
With a shrug, T asked,
"Theoretically, if I could find wheels like that, what's in it for me?"
"You wouldn't have to worry about Valdemar anymore."
"You planning to kill him?"
"Do you really want to know what I plan to do?"
"I want to know you ain't fucking with me."
"You have two choices here, T."
Trust me to play you straight, or trust Valdemar not to add your sorry carcass to his collection.
Yeah, T said,
and he settled back into his chair to decide who here was the lesser evil. It was an easy choice. Mary returned to the apartment. She couldn't think of it as home anymore. To find several $100 worth of probable cause spread across the living room. The hall included nondescript coveralls, boots, disposable painter's booties, form-fitting leather gloves, baseball caps, bandanas, a box of heavy-duty garbage bags, duct tape, a length of chain, a padlock, 3 burner cell phones, 2 duffel bags, a solid steel hatchet with an elongated shaft, and a pair of machetes with long, black blades. "It's not a cutlass," Anne said, handing one of these last items to Mary, "but close enough." On that count, Anne was right. The weapon lacked any kind of proper hilt, and the balance was off. Most of the blade's weight was at the tip instead of the base. But for their needs, it would serve. As instructed, Anne and Julie drove west to do their shopping in Springfield and its surrounding towns. They paid cash at every stop, of which there were many, even though they could have easily purchased everything in 1 or 2 stores. They alternated buying duties so they were never spotted together in any given location, refused assistance when offered so no employee could get too familiar with their appearances or mannerisms, and always parked as far away as possible to avoid getting picked up by security cameras. "We were careful as we could be," Anne said. "I know you were," Mary said. "And how did your errand go?" Julie asked. "Promisingly, but I won't know for sure until my man comes through."
"You think he will?"
"He has plenty of incentive. 2 of his friends are hanging in Valdemar's meat locker, and I think he knows he's 1 misstep away from joining them."
"Hardly a guarantee," Anne said.
"And how many guarantees are there in life, Miss Bonnie?" Julie said.
"Death and taxes," Anne laughed. "Well, taxes."
Julie assumed the responsibility of ordering takeout for dinner, and left Anne and Mary to the task of wiping down the equipment with paper towels misted with Windex. Once satisfied every fingerprint had been erased, Mary packed everything into the duffel bags and tucked those in the bedroom closet, throwing them atop a haphazard pile of shoes. All hers, she noticed. That realization sparked in her a new level of awareness, something akin to what Owens called the observer expectancy effect, a.k.a. the red car effect. If you bought a red car, you would suddenly become keenly aware of all the other red cars on the road. Mary took in all the available space in a closet that had previously been occupied by men's dress shirts and suit jackets. The tie rack, one of those cheap motorized jobs that department stores only sold around Christmas time, was no longer hanging on the back of the door. She returned to the bedroom and did a slow turn. 2 framed pictures, 1 of Calvin's parents, the other of his sister, were missing from the wall, along with a print he'd bought 2 years ago during a day trip to the vineyard, an artsy photo of a snow-encrusted Main Street. She loved that photo. And she loved the quilt that Calvin's grandmother made for them, the one that used to sit neatly folded atop the wooden chest at the foot of their bed, ready for use on cold winter nights, or those rare occasions when the bedroom air conditioner, also missing, did its job too effectively. Mary wandered into the living room, as stiff as a sleepwalker, her subconscious cataloging all the new blank spots on the walls, all the gaps in the rack of Blu-rays, and on the bookshelves, the empty windowsill upon which once sat the fern she bought, the one she watered, the one she pruned of its brown curling leaves.
"Mary," Anne said, "what's wrong?"
"What?"
"You're crying."
Mary blinked. Hot tears prickled her eyes.
"I'm fine," she said.
Anne rolled over. The bed beside her was empty and cool to the touch. She sat up, and a flush of disorientation manifested as an unpleasant flutter in her chest. A bead of sweat trapped in her hairline shook free and oozed down the side of her face, thick and warm, like the air itself. "He had to take the air conditioner. Bastard." Anne slid out of bed and knelt to feel about in the darkness for her tank top and her jeans, and once dressed, she crept through the unfamiliar apartment,
A glow spilling out from the kitchen lit her way through the living room, where Julie lay asleep on the couch under a borrowed sheet. Slumber granted her features a serenity that struck Anne as profoundly misplaced. Mary stood in the corner of the kitchen, head bowed and her arms crossed at her belly. A small fluorescent light above the sink cast her naked form in stark highlights and hard shadows. "I couldn't stop thinking," she said.
"About what?"
"If this all goes according to plan," a bitter twist of a smile flickered on her lips. "If this all goes according to plan, Valdemar will be off my back for good, and I can go back to living my life, whatever that is nowadays. If this all goes according to plan." And how often has that happened in our lives?
"Often enough.
For the small things."
"This isn't a small thing."
"No."
Anne crossed the kitchen. "We'll make this work. All three of us."
"Yeah."
"And between you and me," Anne said, smirking, "if Julie does help us pull this off, I'll let her have her wicked way with both of us."
Mary quirked an eyebrow. "Really?"
"No, not really." Anne slipped her arms around Mary's waist. "I'm done sharing you."
Mary smiled, but it was thin, melancholy. "Might all be a moot point, love. When this is all done, I won't be the same woman standing here now. I can't promise I'll..."
"No, stop.
Anne.
Please, let me have this. Let us have this."
"All right." Anne took Mary by the hand and led her back to the bedroom. They lay in bed together, arms and legs entwined, breathing each other in.
"No matter what happens, I'm with you until the end," Anne said. "You know that, don't you?"
"I know that," Mary said. "But I don't want this to end. Not again."
"Only one thing to do about it, eh? We raise hell as only Anne Bonny and Mary Read can. No quarter asked, none given. No prisoners."
"And no mercy," Mary said, those words fading to a whisper as sleep at last claimed her. 24. For 1 week, Mary woke up, went to work, did her job, and returned to the apartment. For 1 week, on alternating days, Anne drove out to the Ham FLD building, parked far enough up the road that she wouldn't be obvious, but close enough that come 5 p.m., after the rank and file had left for the evening, she could see the long black luxury sedan pull up to the front awning and receive its lone passenger, and followed at a discreet distance until she was certain the car was ferrying its charge back to his secluded Sturbridge home. The routine was, based on her limited sample, reliable and consistent. For 1 week, Julie lounged on the sofa and sipped wine, but she was far from idle. She spent the time poring over Mary's plan with a ruthlessly critical eye, looking for flaws, of which there were many. The concerns she raised were taken seriously and addressed when possible, but ultimately she had to concede hers was a task worthy of Sisyphus, and perfection would remain forever out of reach. Enemies, they all agreed, had a frustrating habit of not following the script. The night before the strike, they ate together in the living room, a somber dinner of takeout paired with a single bottle of wine, so no one would wake up hungover, and went to bed early. Before going to sleep, Mary and Anne made love, quietly, but not silently. Julie, from her guest quarters in the living room, joined in spirit. A thunderstorm passed through the city after midnight, brief, but violent. "Do you have it?" Mary typed, and she pressed the send button. She stared at the phone until the response came, nearly a half hour later. "Got it. You be happy." "Good. Be there soon. Delete these texts," she replied, and then she followed her own advice and erased the thread. "Tea came through," she announced.
"So he claims," Anne said. "He could be setting you up."
"No more second-guessing, love. It's time to fight like women or die like dogs.
When you put it that way."
Julie, unusually somber, held out her hands. Mary and Anne took them, then clasped hands themselves. That I once exhumed a dead nun and burned down a convent speaks to my relationship with God, Julie said. But my time among the sisters imparted some perspective and insight I previously lacked. Even if one does not believe in a higher power, faith matters. I have no faith in a just God who will bring us through this. She tightened her grip. But my faith in you, my dear friends, is absolute, and I will stand with you both until the very end. Mary, never one for stirring speeches, looked to Anne for a final rallying cry. All she said was, "Until the very end." "Let's go," Mary said. Anne let Mary out 3 blocks away from Bermuda, and after a final kiss for luck, drove away so she and Julie could make their necessary preparations. Mary waited until the car was out of sight, and then slung the strap of her duffel bag across her chest. The bag seemed to grow heavier with each step. The curb outside Bermuda was empty. Mary refused to take that as an omen for good or ill, but she nevertheless pulled her Glock, just in case Anne's fear that T had suffered a last-minute attack of cold feet and decided to sell her out proved harsh reality. Mary checked the time. 15 minutes had passed. Anne and Julie should be out of Worcester by now. Good. If she called this wrong and opened the door to find Hammond on the other side, gun in hand, at least they wouldn't pay for her folly. The garage was quiet and empty of people and of cars, except for a black Ford Suburban. Mary guessed it was at least 10 years old, but it appeared to be in good condition for its age. A note tucked under the windshield wiper read, simply, "Keys inside. Be gone by 5. Mary spared a few minutes to check the office, the bathrooms, the back storeroom. She was alone. She dropped her bag and circled the vehicle, inspecting it for anything that might attract a bored Stady's attention. A crack in the taillight, a muffler hanging precariously from the undercarriage, a license plate with a little too much road grime on it. The paint had some nasty scratches on a rear quarter panel. Someone had keyed it, fairly recently, and the vehicle as a whole would have benefited from a run through a car wash, but it passed visual muster, down to the valid inspection sticker. Mary opened the driver's side door, and the vehicle dinged at her insistently. A key without an attached keyring sat in the ignition. A flash of paranoia sent a chill rippling through her. She popped the hood and checked the engine compartment for any wiring that seemed out of place, then crawled underneath the vehicle to examine the gas tank, without precisely knowing what she was looking for. A brick of clay-like material attached to a remote detonator felt more Hollywood than real life, but she had no other point of reference. The department had a few officers versed in improvised explosives, but no proper bomb disposal experts from whom she might have gleaned something useful. Grimacing, Mary got off the oil-stained garage floor, slid behind the wheel, and twisted the key. The engine turned over immediately, without a hint of strain or resistance, and settled to a low, smooth hum. She let out a groan. Once her nerves settled, she got out to perform a second all-over inspection. Satisfied, as much as she could be, she stuffed her sneakers in the duffel bag and slipped into the boots and coveralls. She tied the bandana around her neck and set her baseball cap on the passenger seat, along with the machete in its canvas sheath. Good to go. She sent the text to Julie. It wouldn't do for things to go sideways now because Anne got stopped for texting while driving. Julie texted back, "See you soon, MDS." Mary didn't pause to roll the garage door back down after she left. The way she figured, T would be so grateful to her for ridding the world of Valdemar, he'd forgive the discourtesy easily. Or she would be dead. At 4:30 p.m. precisely, 3 prepaid cell phones purchased for short money at 3 different convenience stores joined in a conference call. This was the first of several calculated risks. The longer the phones remained active, the longer local relay towers would have to pinpoint and track their respective locations throughout the evening, thus firmly establishing opportunity, perhaps the most important element of a district attorney's prosecutorial foundation. Means and motive could be easily attached to almost anyone in a given criminal case, but an ironclad alibi? That was the trump card every prosecutor dreaded. Mary turned the SUV off, settled in, and braced for calculated risk number 2 to play out. If Ham didn't go home right away, she'd have to make a tough call. Stay put and wait for an opportunity to present itself later that night, or withdraw and try again at a later date. Neither option was desirable. Either one came with its own further complications. Mary's heart leapt when a Sturbridge police cruiser passed by her staging area at the entrance to the Tantiasquis, a small nature reserve at the southwestern edge of Leadmine Pond. She'd chosen the tiny parking lot for its proximity to the Ham estate. His home was on the other side of the pond. And for its relative seclusion. A parked car here wouldn't draw as much undue attention as it would in the middle of a residential neighborhood filled with alert parents. But it wasn't invisible. Calculated risk the third. Only now, too late to do anything about it, did she realize a spot like this must regularly attract horny teenagers. Perhaps the occasional dealer. And might be subject to regular police drive-bys. Mary added it to her mental worry list as calculated risk 3.5. "I see Ham's car," Anne said. Mary drew a sharp breath. Anne was calculated risk number 4. If Ham's driver was an attentive sort, he might notice that the same red Mazda that had followed him on 3 separate but recent occasions was behind him once again. Time to find out. Ham's limo took a left out of the parking lot, Anne said, with a note of optimism Mary regarded as premature. There were many more turns between Ham's business and his home. Many more opportunities for Ham to unwittingly foul their plan. Anne updated her progress infrequently, but with every check-in, the ember of hope burning low in Mary's chest brightened a little more. By the time Anne called in the critical turn off of Route 15, the ember had grown to a roaring bonfire. "You're out," she said. "Head to the rendezvous." "See you soon," Anne said. "La M, he's coming," Mary said. "You're up."
"D'accord," Julie said.
Mary pressed the phone to her ear and strained to make out a susurrus of dry leaves crunching underfoot. The rustling ceased, and for several nerve-wracking seconds, she heard nothing. Then came a dull thud and a faint metallic jangle, the tinkling of steel links playing against one another.
"Done," Julie said.
Mary started up the SUV. She circled around Leadmine Pond, her chest heaving as though she was sprinting on foot toward her destination. Her eyes leapt from the road ahead to the rearview mirror to the sideview mirrors, expecting to see that Sturbridge cruiser racing toward her, fully lit up.
"He's coming," Julie said.
Tires chirped in protest as Mary whipped around a hairpin left onto Bennett's Road. The pitch of the Suburban's engine grew higher, sharper. The SUV fishtailed as Mary careened onto the final stretch, the unnamed private road leading to the Ham estate. The thick woods on either side passed in a blur. Mary jammed the cap on her head and pulled the bandana up around her face. Ham's car sat in front of the iron gate separating the driveway from the property itself, a gate now sealed with a length of chain and a padlock. The driver, part way out of the vehicle to inspect this curiosity, spotted the Suburban roaring up and jumped back into the car. Mary stomped on the brakes and spun the SUV neatly into place, across the width of Ham's only escape path. Mary stepped out, gun drawn and raised, and trained on the driver's side window. She circled around until she could make out the chauffeur's silhouette behind the smoked glass. "Out," she ordered. And she made a show of thumbing the hammer back, hoping the show would end there. Opening fire meant providing police with damning ballistic evidence. Calculated risk number 5. The watery shape behind the wheel moved. Muffled voices shouted at one another. The door clicked and eased open. The man who emerged was on the far side of middle-aged. Gray tinted his 5 o'clock shadow and his temples. He raised his hands above his head compliantly, causing his suit jacket to flare out. He had no weapon hiding under his arm.
"Who else is in the car?"
Mary asked. The driver, who wore the expression of someone who didn't sign up for this shit, said,
"Mr. Ham, a bodyguard. He's armed. Please don't—"
"Shut up." The man nodded spastically. Mary nodded toward the back door. "Open it." Moving at a snail's pace, his gaze fixed on the gun trained on his heart, the driver reached for the controls set into the armrest of his door.
He pressed a silvery switch, and the back doors unlocked with a soft pop. The groan of hinges in need of a good oiling was as good as an alarm.